This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's Thanksgiving special, we'll bring you a collection of stories.
From a terrifying encounter with a mountain lion.
Yeah, it very much turned into just a full-on fight for survival.
To how the arts are helping to tell stories in unusual ways.
To be able to go out and step out of the prison itself.
That and more coming up.
It's Thursday, November 28th. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Today, we're bringing you a special episode featuring some of our favorite stories KUNC told this past year. We'll bring you pieces that explore storytelling through the arts, and we'll look at the history of how an iconic high-altitude race came to be. But we're going to start today's show with a rather unusual love story.
Each year, as summer comes to a close and the nights cool down, tarantulas in southeastern Colorado emerge for a few hours at dusk to search for a mate. KUNC's Esther Honig traveled south, hoping to catch a glimpse of the spiders in their annual migration.
Growing up in Colorado, I always assumed that large, hairy spiders lived in the tropics or as pets inside aquariums. But the Oklahoma brown tarantula, which can get as big as a grapefruit, is common in the southeastern corner of the state. And this is the time of year when they're most visible. So I went to Pueblo, where a local expert took me tarantula hunting.
I love watching them, like, eat, hunt, stuff like that. I think it's really cool.
Heath Merchant is 22 and loves invertebrates the way most people think of puppies. He grew up catching tarantulas in Trinidad, and now, as a student of wildlife and natural resource management, he knows a lot about them.
They call it a migration. They're not migrating like, you know, birds go south for the winter. It's not that kind of thing. It's males out looking for mates.
The males will often travel up to a mile to find a female in her burrow. And they're easy to spot when they crawl across roads and through open prairies. We set out at dusk and wander through the fields behind the campus at Colorado State University, Pueblo. Merchant has no fancy nets, just his bare hands. Whatever we catch will go into his bug zoo, which he uses to teach elementary students about wildlife.
Part of my hopes with that was try to eliminate those fears, you know, so you know, some kids get taught to be afraid of tarantulas.
Like me. In fact, most spiders give me the creeps, which makes me an odd choice for this assignment.
And they're not very fast moving, right?
Oh, the tarantulas?
Yeah.
They can get up and go pretty good.
Yikes. That sounds scary.
We walk around for over an hour.
Oh, but no.
Oh, that's just a stink bug.
Ah.
By now, the sun has set and we haven't seen a single tarantula.
I feel like it's just a little early in the year yet.
Okay.
I feel like usually mid to even maybe late September is a little bit more prime.
Merchant says evening temperatures are still too hot and peak tarantula mating season won't be for another week. But I'm on a deadline. So the following day, I head further south to La Junta. It said the Comanche National Grassland is prime tarantula territory. In her office, Michelle Stevens with the U.S. Forest Service unfolds a large map.
I recommend that you drive south on Highway 109.
She shows me the best routes for tarantula viewing.
You could come down to Vogel Canyon.
This summer, articles about La Junta's tarantulas have taken off online. And Stevens has seen an uptick in tourists hoping to catch a glimpse of them.
I think that it's a big moment for tarantulas in this region.
It's also provoked plenty of calls from those who fear herds of them will sneak up, crawl into cars, and attack.
That sounds like a great B movie, but it is not really what reality is.
These tarantula travel solo, and most visitors will spot just a few. Like most wildlife, they only bite when harassed, and they're not even venomous to people. Now all I need to know is if I go out and search for them, will I find any?
It's still pretty hot. Now on Friday, the temperatures are supposed to be quite a bit cooler, maybe 20 degrees cooler.
You're making me feel really confident. This is great.
The next evening, with map in hand, I set out to the Comanche National Grasslands.
We'll just have to see if the tarantulas are out tonight or not.
As the sun lowers, an hour goes by.
And now we have rain, so.
Assuming tarantulas don't like rain, the night feels like a bust.
I'm gonna drive to the end of this road and I'm gonna drive back and we're gonna go home.
Then as the storm clears and the sun dips behind the horizon.
I have just spotted one. I just saw one.
At the edge of the road is a distinct silhouette of a very large spider.
I just saw him. He like, oh shit.
I kneel down to get closer, and rather than feel terrified, I'm actually a bit moved.
And this little guy is making the trek of his life to go find his lady.
Before I can pull out my camera, he's gone. It was enough to see just one tarantula. But for anyone traveling here between now and mid-September, they can be sure to see many more. Esther Honig, KUNC, La Junta.
Now, Esther went looking for an animal, but what happens when an animal comes looking for you?
Well, in February, a Colorado man fought for his life in the foothills outside Fort Collins. With nothing more than rocks and his bare hands, he killed a mountain lion that sprang an ambush attack on a popular running trail. The story captured attention around the world. Reporter Luke Runyon from KUNC caught up with the man and has his story.
Travis Kaufman headed out for a run around noon in shorts and a fleece pullover. He skipped the earbuds, instead opting for the sounds of his own footsteps on the trail. About halfway through his run, he stopped to take in the view from the top of a ridge. The 31-year-old, at 5'10" and 150 pounds, started to descend on a narrow, wooded section of trail.
And I just kind of heard some pine needles rustling behind me, and I stopped and turned. It's one of those situations where sometimes I turn, sometimes I don't.
Because it's usually a deer or a squirrel. But this time, he decided to turn around to see what made the noise.
In this case, it was, in fact, a mountain lion. And so I remember seeing that and just having my gut feel the full impact of the situation.
Kaufman put up his arms and screamed in an attempt to scare the cat away.
Unfortunately, it kept running, and then it eventually just lunged at me. And at that point, I was able to get my arms up kind of in front of my face and block its initial like lunge with its claws and mouth.
The cougar started scratching.
Its jaws locked onto my hand and wrist and pretty much stayed there the whole time.
It wrapped itself around Kaufman's body and dug its front claws into his back. He tried to throw it off, but with its mouth clamped around his wrist, the two ended up tumbling more than 20 feet off the trail into a gully.
But during that fall, the cat ended up on its back, and it still had my wrist this whole time in its mouth, and it was kind of thrashing at me with its front and back claws.
Kaufman used one of his legs to pin the animal's hindquarters to the ground and then searched for a way to fight back. He grabbed sticks, but they were rotted and crumbled when he tried to use them against the cat. With his free hand, he found a rock and began hitting it over the head.
You can tell it stunned it, but it started thrashing a little bit more, and its back legs got free at that point and scratched the back of my calves and then some more on my thighs a little bit.
Kaufman regained control and was able to repin the animal's back legs.
I got my right foot onto its neck, and then I was able to get some weight onto its windpipe, and that's what eventually suffocated it, and then at that point, it released my hand.
The whole battle lasted about 10 minutes.
One of the thoughts that I was having was like, well, this would be a pretty crappy way to die. Just up on the side of the mountain, screaming and having like a little, this cat like wrapped around my wrist, and then like eventually another cat comes in and takes me out, and then getting eaten by a bunch of mountain lions. And it's like, that wouldn't be an ideal way to go.
You had that thought in the moment?
I did, yeah. So, yeah, it very much turned into just a full-on fight for survival.
After suffocating the cat and covered in scratches and puncture wounds, Kaufman started running again.
I was just kind of looking around and just feeling like I was being watched by cats on all sides, because I really took in my surroundings a little bit more and then realized that the whole west side of the trail was filled with rock overhangs and just kind of prime mountain lion territory.
Shaken from the attack and miles from his truck, he eventually encountered another runner and two hikers. They gave him water and the use of their phone. One of the hikers drove Kaufman to the emergency room, where he got more than 24 stitches on his face, closing the wounds on his cheeks and nose. Once he was safe at the hospital, Kaufman had time to think about the gravity of what just happened.
You know, people presented in certain situations, they would make the same decision. if you come down to it and you're being attacked and you don't really have much recourse besides killing the animal to get yourself out safely.
News of the attack went viral. State wildlife officials temporarily closed the open space where the attack occurred and removed two other juvenile mountain lions from the area to a rehabilitation center. They're possible siblings of the cat Kaufman killed.
For the most part, like during the whole process, I didn't really make that many decisions. It was a lot of just kind of like instinct. And so there weren't a lot of decisions to second guess or like a lot of critical moments that I had to like rethink or go through and reprocess. So for the most part, I don't feel any residual trauma from it. And I don't know, I tend to like to move forward too with things. That's just kind of my personality.
Kaufman's takeaway from this incident is that the foothills might feel like a place just for people, for recreation, but they're wild. He says the decision not to listen to music while running saved his life. He heard the mountain lion coming before he saw it, and that might have given him the edge. Luke Runyon, KUNC, Fort Collins.
Over the holiday season, you may be running to burn off some extra calories. Hopefully, nothing as eventful as Travis Kaufman's run back in February.
And perhaps not as extreme as, say, training for a 100-mile race held at a location that's more than 10,000 feet above sea level.
Which sounds pretty difficult.
Doesn't it? That's what the runners of the Leadville Trail 100 do every summer. We spoke with race founder Ken Klober on the eve of this year's race, and he told us the story of how the race came to be. Now, you used to work in the mines in Leadville, and then...
Oh, yeah, and that, in fact, our whole town did, and that's the genesis of the Leadville Trail 100.
Tell us the story.
I was an underground shift boss at the mine, loved it. Every day I'd go 600 feet straight down and about a mile, a little better back underneath that mountain and go to work. Went to work one swing shift, and we got all ready to go underground. The crew got ready and started to get on the lift to go underground, and got a phone call from the mine boss and wanted all the shift bosses to come up to the office. We jumped in pickups and ran up there, and it was a very short meeting. He said, "We're closing the mine. Go back, tell your crews to go home. Their unions will be in contact with them tomorrow. You go home, management hands will be in contact with you tomorrow." Mm. And that was it. We lost 3,250 jobs that night, and in a community of 5,000, that was everybody. Everybody. We were the highest unemployment in the nation, just with one mine closing. So.
And I bet that was devastating for the whole community.
Oh, it was. It was, because we not only lost our income, we lost our identity. No longer we're miners. We're just out on the street. Well, our community got together. We knew we had to do something. We had to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. Critical ingredient was Governor Lamb. He came down to our community, talked to us. We formed a little committee, the Leadville Improvement Group, and he talked to us and he said, "To save your town, you got to bring people in to spend money, and you got to save your schools, and you got to save your hospitals. If you don't save your school and your hospital, then you're headed for ghost town."
Okay.
He said, "The key to getting people to spend money when they come to your town is that they stay overnight." So that was the trip trigger. We were all looking for reasons to get people to come to our town to stay overnight. We had suggestions for all kind of different events and fairs and whatever, and suggestion of various length of foot races. And then I had been involved just in some longer races. And so the numbers, getting people to stay overnight in our town, one little unnecessary stoplight at 10,200 feet, all those zeros just resonated with us, and so I decided, well, if they come here to run 100 miles, they're doggone sure going to stay overnight. So we had our first race in 1983, and it just grew and grew. The real boost to us came, television got a hold of it. And from that point on, we had more people signing up, that wanted to sign up for the race than what we thought we could handle. So
that's a great thing.
It's been a success for our community ever since. It's always been about what we could give, not what we could get. Turn that money around to our community. And then bottom line, we're changing life, too. We're bringing people here from all over the world and teaching them how to be Leadville tough. Yeah.
Now, you yourself have run the Leadville 100 a number of times. I mean, what is it like to do that at that altitude?
You know, this is something coming from our mining background. When I started this 100-mile race in underground mining, you never wanted to ask anybody on your crew to do anything, to crawl in any hole or light any amount of dynamite that you weren't willing to put yourself on the line for. So, yes, started running those races from the very first one. I paid my entry fee just like everybody else, and I managed to finish 14 of them, 14 100 Leadville Trail 100s. So I've got my 1,000-mile buckle that I proudly wear.
Now, do you have any advice then for runners?
Absolutely. We can do, and this is the best thing we're doing. We're sharing Leadville grit, guts, and determination with the people that visit our community. And we tell them, if you're tough enough, you've got to believe in one thing. You've got to believe in yourself. Because if you don't believe in yourself, nobody else is going to believe in you.
Ken Klober is the founder of the Leadville 100. Thank you so much for sharing the story with us. This was amazing.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
Now we're going to look at how the arts are helping people across Colorado tell stories.
Earlier this year, KUNC's Stephanie Daniel attended a play, but this play didn't feature professional actors. It was performed by inmates, and it's a part of University of Denver's new Prison Arts Initiative.
Inside a gymnasium in Northeast Denver, a group of actors are performing the play One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. The narrator is Chief Bromden, a catatonic, half-Native American man who talks to the audience through hallucinations.
They got wires running to expand units planted in our heads.
It's about a group of men locked in a mental institution who long to be free. And the theme of the story is not lost on the male actors. All are inmates at the Sterling Correctional Facility, including Douglas Miko, who plays Chief Bromden.
I think the best part has been being able to express myself, to be able to go out and step out of the prison itself, the prison, the mentality.
Miko has been in prison for over 16 years for violent crimes. Today, he swapped his forest green Department of Corrections uniform for a Native American-inspired costume, including a fur vest and a black hat over his long black hair. Ashley Hamilton is the director.
I've been doing this work for almost a decade, and I deeply believe in the power of arts and education inside prison as a way to create transformation for both folks inside, but also in supporting the system as it grows and changes as well.
Hamilton is also the founder of the University of Denver Prison Arts Initiative, or DUPI for short. There are other programs like dance, creative writing, and even a podcast at 10 facilities in the state. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is the program's first full-length play.
It's a really hard play to do, I mean, in general, but in prison, I think especially, because it deals with themes of power and institutionalization and mental health.
Since April, Miko and the others in the production have worked on everything from the music to set design to stage managing.
I look at it like professional workforce now, like it's a job.
By the time they got to tech rehearsals, the actors and crew were putting in 10 to 12-hour days.
I don't have to like everybody. I don't have to be best buddies. But when we're here, we have to accomplish. We have to set goals, attain the goals, set higher goals, and begin to work as one unit. And we've done that, and I'm very happy.
With everything in place, the cast and crew recently traveled from Sterling to perform the play at two prisons, including the Denver Women's Correctional Facility. Ryan Long is the warden.
It's a great opportunity for us to provide them another outlet of expression and to bring humanity, more humanity, back into incarceration and institutions, and then provide them an opportunity to get out of what they normally do.
The audience is a mix of visitors and female inmates. The women, dressed in green pants and yellow t-shirts, sit together on one side of the gym. They are immersed in the performance.
Medication, all patients of the day on medication.
Afterwards, Jemaila Nelson says she can relate to the story. She's been incarcerated for about 10 years.
The toothbrush situation where they said that the toothpaste was locked up. And the guy couldn't get it. And I just, small things like that, and within facilities, which I think is changing now, but Back in the day, it used to be really petty, and things that didn't matter mattered so much.
Nelson is serving a life sentence without parole for what she says was a domestic violence relationship that went wrong. She's also part of DUPI and will be in the next big play, A Christmas Carol, with other women in the facility.
I'm ready to go, man. I'm just so excited. I hope that we get to travel like this.
Nelson feels the Department of Corrections is going somewhere by trying to normalize prison through art. She says today is a prime example.
This will be just an honor. It'll be hopefully it will shift the paradigm of society, and so that they look at us differently. And a lot of people in here, we want to change. We have changed.
Stephanie Daniel, KUNC, Denver.
For our last story, we're going to look back at the history of our state through a unique lens.
For years, a postcard was kind of the text of the communication world, a way to send someone a few quick lines with a photo or artwork on the front to brighten their day. But for one Estes Park archivist, the search for one particular kind of postcard has turned into a decade-long quest. KUNC arts reporter Stacey Nick has more.
John Meisner strolls into Greeley Antique Shop, Lincoln Park Emporium, and right away, a display of postcards near the counter catches his eye.
These are amazing because you never see, this is like new old stock. So they're perfect. It's like they just came from the printer.
The cards, which are placed next to some boxes of candy, depict Colorado tourist spots such as Red Rocks. They're all from Denver's Sanborn Souvenir Company. The cost? 25 cents a piece.
Which is a very fair price, and it just shows you postcards right now are tough to sell.
But not all of them. These are from Bill Sanborn and were shot in the 1960s and 70s. Now, a postcard by his father, Harold Sanborn.
That can be a $100 or a $200 card.
Why so much for what is essentially just a piece of paper? Harold Sanborn started the Sanborn Souvenir Company out of downtown Denver in the 1920s. For the next 40 years, the commercial photographer traveled throughout Colorado and Wyoming, taking pictures of local places of note, anything he thought might make a marketable postcard. Now Meisner goes from town to town, scouring antique shops and flea markets on the hunt for Sanborn postcards. And most of the time, he comes up empty-handed.
Most of these are chromes or printed or lithographs, but there are some very interesting real photo postcards in here.
Thanks to careful notes still kept by the current owner of the Sanborn Souvenir Company, no relation to Harold, Meisner knows that over his career, Sanborn shot more than 10,000 different views for his real photo postcards.
We know how many he produced, but we don't know the views.
To prevent his photos from appearing dated and keep them commercially viable, Sanborn took photos without people or vehicles in them.
But the problem is they look somewhat lifeless and somewhat flat.
But that's not what Meisner and many other collectors throughout Colorado and the country are interested in. It's the connection to local history.
He made an attempt to go into every town and city in Colorado and Wyoming and take their civic buildings, their churches, their courthouses, their post offices, but also their smaller businesses. So their restaurants, their cottage courts, their gas stations.
Which is why Meisner helped found the Estes Park Archives, a group of armchair archaeologists working to curate a collection of memorabilia from the town's past, everything from photographs to phone books. Since Sanborn shot a large percentage of his work here, his postcards have become a focal point for the group.
Yes, it might be something common. Yes, it might be Long's Peak. And we have plenty of pictures of Long's Peak. But it may be a business that existed in the Big Thompson Canyon. Or it may be a cottage that was in Glen Haven that this is the only picture we're ever going to have of it.
But after 10 years of searching around the country, they've only found 60% of Sanborn's postcards from the area. Now they're reaching out to the community for help.
We spread the word. We let people know, here's what we're interested in. If you've got postcards, even if they're not Sanborns, we're very interested in looking at them. We're active buyers of them.
They've spent into the six figures obtaining the collection so far. Eventually, they'll sell the duplicates and create a book on the postcards, along with a digital archive so that anyone can see the cards online. About two-thirds of the way through the box in front of him, John Meisner gets a smile on his face.
Here's a Sanborn.
It's an image of Echo Lake looking out towards Mount Evans. The card is from 1928, but it's a printed card, what those in the business call a linen card.
I'm actually going to set that aside because I may end up buying them.
It's not one of the real photo postcards he's looking for, although it is very collectible. But behind it all, Meisner says what he really hopes is to inspire other citizen historians like himself.
And I think that benefits everyone. I think the more that we learn and the more that we share, the more that we understand our past, which helps us kind of understand where we're going.
In the end, Meisner did end up buying that postcard.
Okay, your title's going to be 642.
One more Sanborn for the collection, helping to mark a moment in Colorado history. Stacy Nick, KUNC.
And that's our show for today. I'm Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. We hope you're having a happy Thanksgiving. Here at KUNC, we're thankful for our listeners and our members who help make programs like this possible.
Thanks so much for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.